Cooper Talk.
Welcome to Cooper Talk. I'm your host, Steve Cooper, and remember, I'm only as hip as my guests. I got to tell you something, people. We have a great show today. You know, it takes one thing to be a successful actor in Hollywood, but then when you become a successful actor, and then you go out and you write a novel, and that starts selling, that's a lot of talent. And my guess, that's what she's doing. She has a great new book called The Light Runner, a novel. And I'm telling you, it's called it's in the reality series book. So I'm guessing there might be another one. And my guest is Allie Walker. How you doing, Allie?
Hey, I'm good. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Good. Now, I want to find out what made you decide to write a novel, because it's such a task. You know, I mean, you know, writing a screenplay is one thing. I've written them. Writing a play is one thing. But writing a novel, I mean, that's like a commitment. I mean, has this something that's been stirring in your head for a while, or tell me about it?
So in 2015, I wrote a pilot that I thought would be great for a limited series and a couple of episodes. And I gave them to the platforms like Apple, HBO, Prime, my platform, representatives gave it to them, and nobody seemed interested. And I really liked it, and I even pitched it in London, but nobody seemed interested. I came close a couple times, but just missed it. And so I kind of put it away in 2016 and 17 after I sent it out. And then I just wouldn't leave me alone. And I thought, well, you know, I've never written a book. I love to read. I love thrillers and mysteries, and it's a psychological, you know, kind of metaphysical thriller. So I thought, I'll just write it as a book. And so I did.
So how did you take it, though, from a script? As I said, there you're talking, if it's an hour pilot, you're looking, you know, scripts are a lot shorter than a novel. And once again, in a pilot, you can say, you know, cut to interior of a barn.
Exactly. Well, it was a real education. I mean, I really had to go back and completely rewrite. I mean, I took the bare bones, but I completely rewrote everything. First 150 pages came from a script, from a few scripts. And so I had to go back and really set the table differently and really kind of create, you know, everything about the players and what was in their heads and what they saw in their, you know, it's very different. You're right. I mean, you know, scripts are more about giving bare bones, and then they set if they're good, they can really set an interesting tone with very few words, which I thought I had done, but I couldn't sell it. And so I went back and just really, as I said, I'm a pretty avid reader, and I'm starting to do that again with novels. And I just decided, you know, I'm going to try this. And so I did.
Now, did you sit down every day and write? I mean, was it a discipline? Because I know we all write different. I mean, I do stand-up comedy, and I'm doing a show this Friday at a 55 and over, which I'm 60, so it's perfect. It's my crowd. I can write for them.
Right.
Today in the shower, I'm thinking, well, I can do this. I've never done this. And it comes to you, and then it starts flowing. But I can't sit down.
Yeah.
How did you attack the novel?
That's kind of, you know, it's weird. I would sit and I would think a lot. I mean, it was weird. I would just kind of, like, when I act, I just kind of daydream about the character, and I daydream about what this person's life is, and I just sort of pretend in my head and make things up, and, you know, so I my character that's, you know, with the information that's been given to me, you know, in scripts easily. But then in the novel, I just sat for days just really trying to think about taking this and bringing it down, you know, from the large kind of amorphic down to something I could put on paper. And after doing that for a while, I just kind of, it flowed out of me. It just, I sat and wrote every day. I usually wrote about 5 to 7, sometimes, well, about 5 to 7 pages a day, and just kept writing. It took me, I guess I started really doing it in 2021. I had re-edited a film that I'd shot in 2020, and then in 2021 I was like, you know, it was still COVID, and I was like, write your book. So I went back and I just sat down every day and did it.
Now, since you wrote, I want to ask you what you think writer's block is. To me, writer's block is not being able to not write. It's when you write and you think everything you write sucks. That's how it is for me. You look at it and you go, oh my God, this is awful. What is writer's block to you? Because you probably incurred it a little bit when you're writing. Even though stuff is flowing, it must pop in some once in a while.
Yeah. You know, some days you just don't want to do it. You know, I have to be honest. I mean, some days you're just not up for it, you know, and I think that's okay. You know, I would be like, I'm not doing it today. I'm tired. Or, you know, I think a lot of it is not really having, like, trying to figure out your point of view, I think, is a lot of it. Trying to figure out the point of view of the book or what you're trying to say. And I think writer's block comes when you're kind of trying to jump to the end too quickly and figure it out. I find that if I don't even know what the hell I'm doing and I just keep going, it comes. I just have to write. But some days, the stuff I wrote was terrible. And I just threw it away. But that's okay. And other days, it was like, oh, great, I got that. You know, I think a lot of it has to do with sometimes you just burn out. And you don't want to write. You're tired. You know, I found myself at some points just like, I don't want to. I'm just exhausted. So I would take a few days off. You know, easily a few days off. Or, you know, like right now, there's the second book in this series. And I've been like, no, I don't want to write. I'm tired. I'm really tired. I've had a lot going on in my personal life and just things are going. And I thought, you know, I'm going to take a break. I have some of it ready to go. And I'm just going to wait, you know, because if you don't feel like writing, you know, it can really bum you out. And I think that's writer's block. You get really bummed out and mad at yourself. And I just don't go there. I just don't go there.
So how many drafts did it take you? I mean, are you someone who, because, you know, some writers sit there and they'll start writing something. I always talk to people who are writers and say, don't do this. They start writing like 20 pages and they go, oh my God, page 5 sucked. So they go back and they change 5 and they never get like past page 25. Where other writers just sit down and go, I got to finish it. That's what edits are for. How many drafts did you do?
One. I did one and then I went to editors and I had 3 editors work on the book, and the first one was kind of an overall edit, how to get it into past and third person, you know, and all that, and then really conceptually, there was a writer named John Perugin, and he's an excellent editor, and he helped me really edit the book, and then I had a light edit with a woman who's been editing for 50 years, Randy Leidenheim. She was wonderful too. And she just did little things like, you know, cops don't do this, or did you see this? And I would cut this and this, and, you know, but I did the bulk of it under one edit with John Perugin. But I edit, I wrote it and then I really edited it. I mean, I cut a lot, you know. I'm a bit repetitive. I would catch myself up at the beginning of every chapter because I would take long breaks. Then I'd be like, I don't need the beginning of this. I don't need the end of that. I don't need the beginning. So I did a lot of editing. But I did one draft. I wrote all the way through.
Now, when you write, and this is why sometimes I get frustrated writing, if you have spell check, if you spell it, I'm the king of the run-on sentences. I can do a sentence, I mean, 15, 20 lines. I blah, blah, blah. That's how I talk in real life. And if you type sometimes, you see, like, you have to put the comma and the blue pops up, the squiggly, and you're like, that's not right, because that's how I talk. Do you keep that spell check, grammar check on, or do you say, screw it, I'm just going to write?
No, I turn it off. I turned it off because a lot of what one of the first edits was correcting that, and it changed everything about what I was trying to say in many instances. And it overcorrected and kind of ruined the flow. And I said, no, I don't want you to do that. Turn it off. And that's grammar, I'm a terrible speller, and I just, like, you know, sometimes I'd be like, oh, thank God for, you know, that. But the punctuation, I'm a bit of a run-on sentence person too. And I like it. I mean, I don't go crazy. It sounds like you're a bit more, but I like it sometimes, and I'm okay with it. So, you know, that's the way the story goes. So I just went, oh, well.
So if someone comes up to you, you know, you just said you did a con. You just did one of the comic cons. And someone comes up and says, hey, Allie Walker, I heard you wrote a book, a novel. It says novel on the title. What What's it about? What are you going to tell them? Because when you read The Light Runner, I mean, you know, you've grown up in the Hollywood, you know, you've been acting for a long time. You know the old punt, you know, the throw a log line, throw a tagline or synopsis. How would you, if someone comes up to you and says, "Hey, Allie, what is your book about?" What do you say?
Yeah, my elevator pitch is not as good as others. I'm never very good at describing my work. I'm good at doing the work, and then I kind of want to get away, you know, and let other people sell it. But I didn't do that in this. It's about a young psychiatrist, Ella Kramer, who her first case in Bainbridge Psychiatric Hospital is dealing with Captain Oliver Haskell, who's checked himself in voluntarily because his wife's been murdered. He's very distraught. And as Ella begins to find out more about him, her own history begins to unravel. And she begins to question the nature of reality and time. And that's only fortified by the patients at Bainbridge, whose mental illnesses actually seem to come out more as special powers and talk about time in a very significantly different way, and about the past, and about that reality is just energy, and you can change that energy like that and enter other dimensions if you want, or change the reality you're living now. So it's a tough pitch. At the base of it, at the bottom of it, it's a murder mystery. And it's about this woman coming undone, basically.
Where did the idea come from? Was it one of those, oh my God, I'm gonna write, I mean, you said you wrote the pilot, but the whole idea of it and the characters, are the characters based on anyone you know? Is the story something that you're fascinated about reality? Where did it all come from?
Yeah, I mean, I've long been fascinated with time, and that I knew things I didn't know how I knew, and gut feelings, and just thinking, you know, having a lot of deja vu, and having a lot of like, I knew that was going to happen, or thinking about someone and seeing them 5 minutes later, or hearing from them on the phone, and all these weird little connections. We all kind of have this sixth sense. We all kind of know, just knowing, tapping into people and kind of knowing who they are before they open their mouth. I mean, a lot of the time, you're just judging or something. But a lot of the time, if you really pay attention to your gut, it knows everything. You know, it's like, it's really, the brain is in the gut. It's really funny because I really believe that. My gut has helped me. It's helped me a lot when I didn't listen to it. I kind of hurt myself in many ways. So it was more like that. And I thought, oh, isn't that interesting? And I thought, if people could just change their realities, if they knew, you know, how to change who they were and how to go back and do things differently. And I had this very weird experience when I was about 22 years old. I was a scientist before I was an actress, and I was a terrible scientist. I really didn't enjoy working in a lab. I loved the people. I loved studying, but I didn't really like working in the lab. So I decided to sell everything I owned and go to Australia. And I remember I was 22 and I got off. I didn't know anybody. I just got on a plane and flew to Australia. And a friend of mine had friends up the coast that I was going to go see. So I took this bus up to the Gold Coast. And I got off at this one spot and there was nobody there. So I walked to the beach and I just started running. I dropped my bags and I had this tremendous sense of freedom. And I just started running in this white sand, and I had this very weird feeling that I was kind of, and I wasn't on drugs, I was kind of watching me do this, as if I'd always been sort of watching my life unfold, as if the older me was watching the younger me set herself free. And it was just this weird experience. And I really didn't tell too many people about it, but it always kind of was in the back of my mind to write something about that, and to think about how I had always kind of gone through hard things in my life and like found this sort of voice or this person comforting me. And I think it was me, obviously, but as an older woman. And I just found that whole idea really fun. And I kind of wrote this whole thing to, you know, I have a very good friend who's an astrologer and a psychic. It's just really intuitive. It kind of freaks me out. And I've had quite a few of those people walk through my life. And I don't know. I just kind of put it all together. And, you know, I love I had always followed quantum mechanics. My father was a physicist. He was a nuclear physicist. Well, he was a theoretical physicist who did work in the nuclear field. And, that's pretty interesting stuff that, the observer dictates the outcome, right? The particles, hitting the board and the patterns. And I don't know. I just found it all like, oh, it's one and the same. Black holes fascinated me, and I'd read about them. Time has always fascinated me. I never thought it was just one-dimensional, And so I made this stuff up. And strangely enough, there's a lot of articles now about the stuff I made up in 2015 being kind of like, oh, yeah, that's happening. And I was like, oh, my God, I'm an idiot savant.
Well, it was deja vu. You had deja vu. You had pre-deja vu, which is
it's like, well, it's weird, right? And I just thought, oh, my God, I'm not that smart. I swear to God, I just made stuff up and thought it was cool,
Deja vu is the weirdest thing. Yesterday, my wife and me are both big Philadelphia Eagles fans, and we always watch the game together. And I'm sitting there, and last week they won by a blocked field goal. And in my head, I was about to say to my wife, I was about to say, this first punt, they're going to block. And I'm watching it, and they block, and they run in for a touchdown. I'm like, holy shit. And I go to my wife, I go, Joanne, I said, I was going to tell you that. And she's like, I believe you. But it's weird when you think, and it's not. And it's the weirdest
thing. You
can't
think it. You have to not outthink it. It's the weirdest thing.
You get that, get that.
By the way, I'm a Philly fan, too. My dad was from Philadelphia.
Okay.
Go Eagles.
Yeah, you get that. Warmth. Like, you just feel it. Like, you're like, I do that with the Philly sometimes. I'm like, this guy's going to get a home run. And you go, oh my God, it's just not like every guy who comes up, but it's an amazing feeling.
Yeah. It's just your gut. You know what you know. And I don't know how, but you do.
Okay. So you were a scientist and you sold everything and you went to Australia. So how do you end up becoming an actor? I mean, because you've been acting and you've been on TV.
Enough, so it's a wonderful story. I had, there's two things I had. I was discovered, basically. I had been in a restaurant in L.A. Well, first of all, I had been in Australia, and I was working illegally. And I was waiting tables, and I poured coffee all over this guy's back, and he started screaming. He stood up and looked at me, and he goes, what are you doing here? You should come work for me. He was a modeling agent. And he said, you should model. You can make money doing that. And I thought, oh, okay. And then I couldn't work there because I was illegally working. I had to go out and get a visa. I didn't have enough money to come and go. I was cheating. I'm sorry, Australia. But I came back to L.A. And my boyfriend at the time was an actor. And he was like, yeah. And he and I were at dinner one night. And I got seen in a restaurant. And I'm a goofball. I'm like kind of funny and goofy. And I was having a great time with him. And this guy came over and said, you have this wonderful way about you. You should really think about, being an actress. And I'm doing this little film, and I was just like, oh, he's a weirdo. And but my boyfriend Tony at the time said, no, that's an actual film, and you should go. And so I got the part, and I did this little film, and then I just started working in production and taking classes. And I had acted some in school, but nothing seriously, and I just started really going after it, waiting tables, and I modeled and I did okay. And then I just, one thing led to another, as it always does, and you just start working, and once I started working, I didn't stop.
Well, you were in Santa Barbara, which was a soap.
Yeah.
And,
that was my big break.
I've talked to different people. Gregory Harrison has been on soaps, a lot of people who've been on soaps. And what people don't get is being on a soap, it's pretty grueling, right? Like, you have to learn a lot of dialogue. Now, given the shots aren't like, we're going to take a week to do an episode. It's like there. So what was it like for you? And you're saying you were in a movie, but this is your big break. It's probably one of your first shows. How did you acclimate to just learning all that stuff? Because once again, you get done what I've heard. You get done your show. They give you a script. You got to be on set the next day and you got to go.
Yeah, well, I flexed my muscles in memorizing in science. I had to memorize a lot of carbon structures for organic chemistry and for stuff like that and for, mathematical theorems and stuff. So I was like, I can do this. I was terrified on the soap. And I had, Scott Jake, Marcy Walker, A. Martinez, Robin Wright, great people around me. You know, Judith, it was a wonderful group around me. And they really, you know, helped me hit my mark, helped me know what to do, helped me see my lighting, helped me, you know, be more natural. You know, like, I really think they are all some of the best actors still that I've worked with. And I really learned a lot from these people. And I'm just very grateful to all of them, you know, because they really, that show really schooled me. That was my school. That was my, you know, you weren't in class in a dark room somewhere in Hollywood doing a scene. You were actually working and you had to hit your mark and you had to know your lines. And you, so it was a wonderful thing for me. And I just, you know, as you always do, you just do what you got to do. And I was really lucky, though, to have such great people around me helping me.
So what happens with Santa Barbara? Does it, why did you leave? Did it end or what happened?
It ended. You know, my character was killed off after a year. I think they had another woman for him to be involved with or something. And but it was fine because I became a Clairol girl. Or was that before? Brandon Tartikoff saw my Clairol ad. I became the Clairol girl. I was the nice and easy girl. which was really funny. And that commercial, Brandon Tartikoff saw it. And I had to go to New York. He asked me to go to New York and meet with Sonny Grasso and his partner, Scott. And they were doing this show called True Blue, a cop show. And I got it. And it was me and a bunch of guys in doing, you know, like the EMS, emergency services unit, stuff. And I was with Tim Van Patten and Grant Show, John Bolger. It was, you know, Leo Burmester, Eddie Albert. It was great. Darnell Williams, great guy, great actor. So it was another step. You know, I got it. I think we did like the first season and then that didn't come back. And, you know, you just keep working.
Now, when you were the Clairol girl, the nice and easy, did people start recognizing you? Because back then, everyone watched TV and everyone watched commercials. Like now, no one watches commercials. You know, you flip. Back then, you know, in Philadelphia, we had channel 3, 6, 10, then UHF 7 and 12, 17, 29, and 48. But you watched it. Yeah. You didn't turn it because we didn't have a remote. You know, yeah, got up and you wouldn't turn it. But yeah. And, you know, but what did people start recognizing you? Because a commercial like that plays all the time and you're going to recognize someone.
Yeah, they started I guess it was around the same time as Santa Barbara. I don't know which came first. I'm so bad about this stuff. But yes, but Santa Barbara, everybody knew me. I mean, everybody. And freakishly enough, France, Santa Barbara was huge in France. Any person who was traveling from France in the United States to this day will go, oh my God, Andrea Bedford, you know, it's a huge show over there. So yeah, but the commercial garnered, I guess, a lot of attention. Yeah. I was on, you know, like five times during the Super Bowl or something. And it was a big spot to get. And it was great, you know, really helped me. And it back then commercials like that were super lucrative. I didn't have to wait tables. I didn't have to, you know, I just kept working as an actress. It was really nice. Knock on wood.
Now, did anyone ever confuse your character on Santa Barbara with you in real life? Because I've heard that happens with people sometimes. You know, like Timothy Busfield was on and he told me how, like, when he was Elliot on 30-something, a lady came up in Studio City at Gelman's or whatever, Gelson's or whatever it is or whatever it's called, and was like, you're such an asshole. You know, did you ever get like, did ever people get your character involved? Because soap people are supposed to be fanatical.
Oddly enough, I sort of had a similar experience, but when I was the villainess, when I was on Sons of Anarchy, that's when people would say kind of bizarre things to me. I mean, I'd always been recognized and people had, they either nice or they pretty much ignore you in LA. You know, I was around the country. I'd get like, it was very nice. I found the fans were always wonderful to me until I did June Stahl and Sons of Anarchy. I get a bunch of people going, you're a bitch and stuff like that. I mean, they'd laugh, you know, but it was like, she was a pretty bad girl. And so people really reacted viscerally to her, but no, I got wonderful things.
Well, you know, after
June, and then it was kind of weird.
After you did True Blue, you did Moon Over Miami, So these are series.
Which I love.
Okay, so
which
tell me about that show. And were you depressed when it, I always wonder, you know, you work hard, you get a series, and you get used to the crew. It's like anything. It's like a job. You know the crew. You know the people. But for
Well, yeah,
you,
it's heartbreaking when a show goes down. It
so
really is.
what did you love about Mood Over Miami? What was made it so special to you?
You know, it was a throwback, like to the Thin Man series, to the 30s, or even to Moonlighting in the 80s. It was these two kind of, you know, she's crazy and he has to deal with her. It was, it made me think of Myrna Loy. And, you know, it was just really fun. Carole Lombard, I kind of got to do screwball comedy, which is what Sybil Shepherd was basically doing on Moonlighting. And it was just wonderful. It was a romantic comedy. I thought the writing, Harley Payton wrote it, and I thought it was terrific. I thought Billy Campbell was like, you know, Jimmy Stewart of the 90s, Rocket Man, right? And I was so happy to get it and felt so lucky that when it went down, I was really bummed out. But you know, that's the nature of the beast, you know, you just gotta keep moving.
Now, at one point, you're starting to make the jump to some movies. Was that because back then it wasn't.
It was right around, let's see, it was right after. Yeah, it was right around then I started getting. When was that? Gosh. Oh, it was before that. No, I did Singles. I did everything all at once. I did Singles, and then I did. What did I do? I did Singles. I did Universal Soldier. I did a bunch of stuff all at once. And then I kind of a dry spell. And then I got Moon Over Miami, and then I went into. What did I do? I did a play in New York, and then I did a bunch of other little indie films, and then I was writing something. And when I was in the process of selling it to Jim Brooks' company, and I was kind of broke. And my writing partner said, "Listen, I'm going to go try to get this job and do it. It's a really interesting job. It's called, you know, Insight, which became Profiler." And I said, "No way are they going to pick. It's a single female lead. No way is this going to happen, probably." And, you know, I really liked the writing. Cynthia Saunders wrote a great pilot. It was more like a movie. And I got it. And then I ended up going. And I got that kind of catapulted me into TV fame, you know, stardom after Moon had failed. But yeah, you just never know what's gonna take off and what's not, you know. And it was like the only single female lead on TV, you know, for a while, and I was just kind of like, wow,
What
it was very fun.
I want to take you back a little bit. What was shooting Singles like? Because first of all, Singles has one of the best soundtracks of a movie, an amazing soundtrack. And
Singles was hard. It was very hard for me because I had been up for the lead for like 6 months and had read against Kyra Sedgwick. She got the lead, and so Cameron gave me a little party because I hadn't really done a lot. I was pretty green. And I mean, I'd done a soap, I'd done a TV series that hadn't gone. And so McCameron was wonderful, and he kept bringing me back, and he kept bringing me back. And he wrote me the part of Pammy from UW, and I was like, yeah, I'd love to do it. I just really, he's one of, you know, say anything. I mean, come on, Jerry Maguire, the guys. So I just really wanted to be a part of it. So I was really happy to get that part. And the music was amazing, the cast was amazing. It was a great experience, you know. Yeah, it was bittersweet. You know, I wished I'd gotten the lead, but I didn't. But you know, it was nice to be a part of it.
Now, Profiler, you get the lead. You're a woman. What is it like at that time? Because this is a different time. This isn't like now. You know, it's not like, you know, female roles. You said you were one of the only lead females. What is it like back then? What was it like being a female and being number one on the call sheet? Because it's something that people probably weren't used to.
It was very nice. I mean, I had a good time. I had a tough time, I think, with the writing sometimes because they would, you know, they got rid of Cynthia Saunders, the creator, and then it was kind of strange because you have different writers with different interpretations, and they needed to keep. You know, Robert Davi, Julian McMahon, and I all felt this way. They changed our characters, so we'd have to go back in and say, "Hey, you know, this isn't what we are. Can you please go back to the way you wrote it before, or the way it was? So that was tough. But I have to tell you, I was very lucky to get the part, and I'm very grateful, you know, to have done it. But I, you know, I met my husband. He was an executive at NBC at the time. And I guess I was pregnant that first year, but good God, with my first child. And, you know, it was great being a female lead. I was very proud of myself. You know, I don't think a lot of women get to experience that. And the character was extremely intelligent, and she was not a woman trying to be a man. She was just smart and interesting, and I loved that. And very, talk about following her gut instincts. Everybody, you know, was like, she was psychic, and I was like, she was just very intuitive. And I liked that description when they gave it to me. I was like, oh, that's great, because I always thought, well, I'm pretty intuitive, but maybe not. I don't know. And I really loved that character. But as we changed writers and time went on, she became a little less interesting. And I was so tired, because, you know, you're working like 14, 16-hour days. And after a couple years of that and having a baby, you kind of get really burnt out. And after the third year, I gave another like half year, and I was like, I can't do this anymore. It was a little too much for me. You know, my body started really, I was expecting my second child, and I was just wiped out. It's hard being number one on the call sheet. It really is, whether you're male or female. But being a female who's pregnant and a female who's having a second, I was just, you know, and there weren't, you know, they had structured it so that I was in every shot. And they, you know, and it just became really hard to do. Really hard to do.
It's hard work. You're right. And there is a lot of responsibility. But in the other side is, you know, you're having you're pregnant with your second child. So you have a family now. You know, the money for a lead is good money. Is it hard to walk away from that? Because I always think, you know.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I was, you know, my husband had a job, but I, you know, he was making a tenth of what I made. And it's like, and I bought the, you know, I had that. I mean, he's more than made up for it, believe me. But, yeah, we were very concerned, but it got to a point where my health, you know, I couldn't keep weight on. I was exhausted. I got like 4 hours of sleep a night. I was like, you know, even my doctors were like, you really, you know, they need to take better care. You know, you're not, you need to, and you know, I just couldn't really keep up. And, so it was very difficult, but yeah, it was difficult to leave the money behind. It was, you know, I was in my mid-30s. It was a great gig. It was a really interesting character. And it set the precedent for all the other shows that followed it. And people kind of forgot about Profiler. But it was, you know, it was Criminal Minds. It was, you know, all the SVU, all of this stuff, this kind of procedural using profilers to find, you know, I hung out with Bob Ressler. I hung out with all the pertinent profilers at the time. I really researched it. It was you know, fascinating. And we were the first ones doing it. And so it was very hard. But in the end, it you know, it worked out the way it should. And that's the way it is.
My wife is a fan of the show, but she found it later. She found it on, like, you know, one of the other, like, networks after it was on.
Oh, right.
And she became a big fan of it. And she loves that. She loves all those kind of TV shows. I mean, I swear to God, if Criminal Minds is on, I'll hear it on the TV. And I always sit there. It's like a walk by. It's like, oh. Well, but it's good.
It's a whodunit. It's a whodunit. It's fun.
So you leave. You're raising your kids. When do you decide to go back into Hollywood? And are you... Is there open arms, or is it like, oh, wait, we remember her, but she hasn't done much lately? What was it like? Because you were in a bunch of stuff.
No, I had produced a pilot that didn't go with Jenji Cohen, who did, you know, Orange is the New Black. And then that didn't work out. And then I kind of took some time, and then I did a couple of recurring, Southland, I did a recurring to kind of get back into it. And then I think... What else? Oh, John Wells wrote an ER with James Woods, a two-parter, and he asked me to do it with James, and I was James' love interest, and so I did that, and then I was like, okay, you know, my kids are getting older, and, you know, I have a nanny I can have come in, and if I'm not the lead, I can, you know, I can work a few days a week, and make some money and enjoy it and not be every day 16 hours, every day 14 hours. And so then I read a script called Tell Me You Love Me. Oh no, what was the other one I did? Oh, I don't know. Which Cynthia Mort wrote, which is some of the best writing I've ever read in my life. And it harkened back to sort of the films of the 70s where people were very, it was very stripped, no pun intended, stripped down because there was a lot of nudity. It was about intimacy and sex in three couples, a very young couple, middle couple in their 30s, and then a couple in their 40s. Tim Decay played my husband, and how intimacy changes. And it was beautiful. And I just thought, this is beautifully written. It's just so honest. And so I read for that and got it kind of immediately. And it was fantastic. And I loved working on that. It was just, you know, there are different types of acting. There are different types of stories. This required you to be so present and so honest. And I just, it wasn't dealing with cases of murder. It wasn't, you know, a lot of the time you have to lay out the plot in other shows and you have to, this was really, I thought, groundbreaking. I really did. And I thought Cynthia did a terrific job. And, you know, I'd worked with Robert Dobby and Julie McMahon, both phenomenal actors. And they were so good. But Tim Decay and I just had something special. And we were just, it was just, you know, like playing ball. You got to catch me. You got to catch me. You know, it was great. And I just thought that was great. It didn't go beyond a year. Cynthia didn't, they wanted to make some changes and Cynthia wouldn't do it. So they kind of respectfully let it go. And that really made me sad. But then Kurt Sutter, who is, I had done a documentary that had won some awards on the foster care system in Los Angeles. And right around the same time, and Kurt Sutter, my husband was at FX at that point, and he was Kurt Sutter, who was a writer on The Shield. I said, "Hey, I want to do The Shield. I'd love to do a guest spot because I loved The Shield." And Kurt had helped me, showed me the ropes and how to get docs out and do stuff, and we became buddies. And then he called me after Tell Me went down. He said, "Hey, you know, I'm doing this show at FX, Sons of Anarchy. You want to come on and do a few episodes for me?" And I said, "Sure." But, you know, John, my husband was working there, so he had to kick it up to the higher-ups to get clearance. And because they don't really like to hire. They don't, you know, nepotism was not a thing there or then. And they said, "Yeah, Allie's, you know, she's a real actor." So I did that, and then they ended up hanging on to me for 3 years. And it was just really fun.
Well, that's another
really fun to be such a.
What are the fans like for that? Because that's one of those fans, Sons of Anarchy fans. It's funny. When I used to record this show in Burbank, and guy played Bobby Munson, big beard. He came into
Bobby
this,
Boone.
Yeah, Boone. He gives me his
Mark
number.
Boone. He's a great guy.
But he was the only person that intimidated me. The nicest guy, but he comes into the studio and he's got his jacket, he's got this big ass beard, and I'm like, holy shit. But he was so nice. And it was just funny because
he's a sweetheart. He's a teddy bear. He's a real love. Exactly. You know, but I used to be into.
People love that show and people love the character. So that must have been something that once again people would call you a bitch, you said sometimes when you're out. But that must have gotten you a new fan base. Because I think on shows like that, with the real dedicated fans, when they see someone, then they go, "Oh man!" If they didn't know about the profile, they'd probably go to IMDb and then they find your other work. So, what was that like for you?
I was great. You know, I didn't realize it was going to be as successful as it was. It was kind of crazy. And you know, Kurt's married to Katie Segal, and Katie was Gemma in it, and she's a terrific. Oh, there's a bug. What is that? She's a terrific actor. It was a great group of actors. I mean, they were a little scary sometimes, you know, they took their jobs very seriously. And so they, you know, there's a lot of testosterone on that set, but I met Drea there and, you know, Charlie, and I loved working with the guys and Katie. I had a great time. You know, I loved my character. I just loved her. She was just so wonderfully psychopathic and sociopathic. I had a ball, you know, and it's like such a, it was such a difference from doing Tell Me You Love Me, which was so, very raw and honest. This was like, she was always in her head, miles ahead of everybody, or so she thought, and it was, the fans were really rabid and really wonderful. And, yeah, I loved them. It was great. It was really, I have to say, the ultimate compliment being called a bitch, because I really sold that part. It was great. They were like, and they would tell me, so nice, the fans would say to me, the only reason we're calling you a bitch is because you really did a great job on that part. And it's so nice when people, recognize your work and realize that, because there I am with my kids in the middle of Target, and they're like, oh man, you're a bitch. You're like, thank you, and you're like, it's really nice of you to stop and say. And they're like, no, really. And it was great.
Now, what was Taxi Brooklyn?
That's funny. Taxi Brooklyn is a show I did that was produced by, I think, Luc Besson's people from France. And it was with Jackie Ito, who was a great actor. And he was in Inglourious Basterds. I love Jackie. He's a great guy. And the lead actress was Seth, and I play her mother, Anna. She was a doll. And it was produced by a French company, Luc Besson's company, I believe. And it didn't go, but I only wanted to do it because of Luc Besson. I mean, I did it because of Jackie and everything in the script, but I love Luc Besson. I love La Femme Nikita is one of my favorite films of all time. I love The Professional. I think he's a, and I was just watching on Instagram. He's got the Dracula, a love tale out in Europe. It's not out here yet, and it looks amazing. And he's just such a great storyteller. I was just so hopeful that I'd get to meet him or something. I didn't, but I worked for him, and it was great, or his company, I guess. But I did that largely out of my adoration of Luc Besson and wanting to be a part of something he did.
So you work a lot. Now, they also end up on Longmire, which that's...
I did. I was offered a part on Longmire to be a love interest to Robert Taylor's character, Longmire, and another show where I was asked if I wanted to do it and then invited back 2 years, for 3 years. Same thing happened with Colony USA. I had a blast because I didn't have to sign contracts saying I would, stay a long time and, get up and go in every day. But when I worked, I really enjoyed it. I didn't make as much money, but I didn't care by that point. We were doing okay. So I just enjoyed the work, It's fun.
Now tell me
and
about...
then I did...
I want to hear about Ghosted.
Ghosted was a blast. I had not worked a little bit. I had just done... I'd just done Colony. And it was coming to an end, I guess. And I really miss doing comedy, because I really hadn't done a lot of comedy since moving over to Miami. And they had been looking, I guess, for the part of Ava LaFrey, the captain, the older woman captain, for a long time. And I went in, and I had known Adam Scott from Tell Me You Love Me. I think he's a terrific actor. He's on Severance now. And I went in and read for everybody and got it. And went to work and had a ball. It was just a hoot. It was just quirky and offbeat. And, Adam and Craig Robinson, tremendous, like so funny and so good at what they do. It was just really fun to be on that, set and doing that. And then Fox got sold and the show went down. So it was just like, oh, well.
So what is it?
Next.
What was it like for you working with those two comics? Because they're both so funny, and it's something that you play a lot of serious parts. You look at your shows, Sons of Anarchy, everything.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, so you're sitting there. It has to be, and as you said, Sons of Anarchy, they took their role serious, and comedians do too. But it's much more lighthearted. I mean,
it's a totally different vibe, and it's different than sitcom funny, which is more ba-dum-bump, and you learn how to tell a joke really well, and your timing is impeccable. This was, one camera, so you could do different takes, and it was just bizarre and like hokey, but so funny. Craig Robinson's delivery. Craig is one of the funniest people I've ever met. I mean, he is just hilarious, And his delivery, I'd be like, during takes, because I would want to laugh. He's talking about being at Panera. And I would just be like, it was just fun. It was really fun.
So
It was really fun to be around people at that level in comedy, too, doing their thing.
now, how did you handle COVID when it came to acting? Because there wasn't work, but you were writing, given, but.
I kind of quit. COVID changed a lot of things. I had shot a film and I re-edited it and put it back out during COVID. It's called Far More. It stars Adrien Grenier and Selma Blair, Andrea DiMatteo, Joshua, really good actors, Bailey Chase. And I shot that back in 2013 and or 14, and it came out in 15, and it was very small, kind of went unnoticed. But then I recut it, and it came out, and it did better. And it's in like 26 countries around the world now. And I wrote and directed that, and that I won awards for my writing in Europe and in here too. And then COVID came around. After I put that, I was sitting around. That's when I was just like, for actors, I think it really hurt us in that I had always gone into a room, usually with a director and a casting director or a star, to read. And now you were being asked to read at home by yourself with, maybe somebody who could read off camera lines, and you had to do the whole thing. And that was not very enjoyable for me. And I found it kind of weird, not having any direct, and I think I was kind of burnt out, and it was like, I don't want to do that. So I kind of took a break, and I've taken a long break now, 6 years from acting, and I just wrote my book, and I put my book out, and I wrote a short, and I will probably do that, and I've got other writing projects I did. But now I'm starting to miss acting again, and I think I'm gonna probably try to go back out and see what's out there. I don't think it's a very good time in the industry. I don't know if anybody will remember me. But I think I might like to try again because I really love being on sets. It's really fun. And I think it's hard because there's not a lot of, I don't know if there are a lot of roles for older women. I hope so, but we'll see.
Well, it's weird because, like you said, I've talked to so many actors who grew up in their career going into the room, and now it's like, people have told me they've gotten parts because a certain look they gave or something reaction, like reading for a different role. I mean, reading for something and people go, "Oh, wow." But now they just look at a video and there's like, okay, it's like a cattle call, and we're talking about not like unknowns.
And they're doing it with a lot of famous, people. Like I would get offers, and I was just like, and they don't do that anymore, really. And it's hard, I think after 35 years to be reduced to the kind of cattle call again. And I just kind of got like, I don't know, man. I'm not. I don't know. I just got kind of tired of. I don't know. I didn't find it fun reading in a room alone, going out, well, I hope that's what, I did it a few times. And I was just like, I hope that's right. I don't know. But I do want to go back to acting in some form, either a play or a movie or a series. I do miss it a lot. I really, that's most of my life I've been on sets,
Now,
large portion of it.
with the book, do you want that to become a movie or a series? I mean, what would be the perfect scenario with this book you have right now?
I don't know. I kind of keep things separate. I mean, I had trouble pitching it, and but now that people know the whole story, maybe they'll do it as a series. But I didn't write it for that. I wrote it to write a book. I'm doing the second book because I like wearing many hats. I really enjoy it. It's very fulfilling to write a novel, and to have finished a novel. And God bless, I've gotten great reviews. I mean, really great reviews overall, and it's been really lucky. And I had the same feeling I'd get into when I was acting, really in in the thick of it, as I did writing the book, I'd just be in my head, you know, in this world of my own. And it's really fun. But at the same time, it gets hard being alone day in, day out, year after year. You know, you kind of want to be like, I gotta go to a set. I gotta go do something. Cause I'm like, you know, and so now I'm thinking that way, but I like to do several things. You know, I doctor scripts for people. You know, I fix, you know, I'm like pretty cool doing anything. I just like to create.
Well, that's awesome.
Come up with.
Well, that's awesome. I'm glad we got to catch up. I know you were jet lagged. It was funny. I've been doing this for so long. It's funny. I know jet lags. When I first started dating my wife, I would fly back from LA to New Jersey once a month. And I would come back, and right. Then, you know, you get back, and she'd want to text me when she was going to work. It was 7 in the morning for her, but 4 in the morning for me. And so I know just your body gets whacked out. But where can
I just kept – every afternoon I'd fall – like last week, I just kept falling asleep, like in the middle of the afternoon. Like, what?
So where's the best place for people to get the book?
Amazon, Barnes & Noble. I think you get it at Walmart. Go to Amazon. And if you like it, leave a great review, please. It's, you can check out my social media, you know, AllieWalker1 on Instagram and Twitter, and AllieWalkerOfficial on TikTok. And then what is it? Oh, AllieWalkerOfficial.com is my website, and you can see where to get the book there. But Amazon's the easiest, probably, or Barnes & Noble.
Okay. Well, so people, go buy the book and go to Allie, all her social media, follow her. Go to my website, coopertalk.net. You can find 1,050 episodes up there. Also, if you're on YouTube, go see my other podcast. Well, I have two other podcasts. The Coop Tank is a local Philadelphia area podcast. I talk to business owners. I just won an Earworthy Award for Best Local Podcast. I have three...
Cool.
Interview. We talk about business and life and stuff like that. Also, Coop's Comedy Corner. Wow. I interview some great TV writers and my comedian friends. And then finally, I just started a new podcast with my friend, attorney John Fogerham. Go look up Lawsuits and Lessons. We talk about the law. I know nothing about the law. He is a lawyer. We have entrepreneurs on. So check that all out. But please go buy Allie's book.
Wow.
Follow me at Cooper Talk on Twitter, at Cooper Talk 1 on Instagram, and Cooper Talk Radio on Facebook. Remember, I'm Steve Cooper. I'm only as hip as my guests. Don't forget, drink your water, eat your vegetables, take your vitamins, and I'll talk to you next time.